Under Ron Johnson's management, JCPenney lost about $1 billion in under 15 months.
If there had been some experimentation, there could have been elements of this that could have been wildly successful. We don't know. But as a combined effort, it took the company down.
Welcome to the Mindful Agility Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Greening. My co-host today is Dan Dixon. Dan Dixon is a Harvard Business School graduate, corporate executive, and management consultant. I'm a PhD computer scientist, startup founder, and agile coach. We seem to end up leading people, and we want our people to be successful. We've been friends for about 20 years. Dan Dixon and I love talking about success and failure. Why do some businesses succeed and others fail? Why do some leaders succeed in one context and fail in others? Ron Johnson led a couple of retail successes and then a couple of retail failures. He created the modern Target department store from humble beginnings and the Apple store from scratch, two huge successes. But what followed was a 17-month stint as CEO of JCPenney that generated big losses, and an 8-year stint at startup Enjoy.com that ended just 2 weeks ago in bankruptcy. So Ron Johnson is a perfect subject for folks looking at success and failure, like Dan and me. If you want to get useful stuff done faster, this podcast is for you. Mindfulness practices help us gain greater insight, while agile practices help us get results. Each episode is an agile experiment to see if we can help you, our listener. The journey is half the fun. After a lot of research and conversation, Dan Dixon and I ended up with 3 episodes on Ron Johnson. Here's what we've got. You are listening to the first episode and an introduction to Ron Johnson and a failure analysis of JCPenney. We'll talk about how failures drove management changes in the past. The second episode introduces agility and mindfulness and uses them as an analysis framework for businesses. Can we predict success and failure using this framework? The third episode will apply the same framework to Enjoy.com. Could this framework help investors figure out whether a company is worthy of their money? So let's start with Ron Johnson, JCPenney, and our failure analysis. People often avoid talking about failure. They may be ashamed of something they did, or they don't want to embarrass somebody else, so they don't discuss failures. The problem is that we can all learn a lot from failure. We all fail occasionally over our lifetime.
And that's really the point of what we're talking about today. There have been any number of articles on JCPenney and Ron Johnson, and most of them have been less than flattering towards Johnson. But that's not our point today. Our point today is to take a look at this and understand why this failure happened and what could have been done to prevent it and to learn from it moving forward.
When we explore exactly what happened and why it happened, we can actually learn to succeed in areas where others fail. That can lead to tremendous success. Ron Johnson's initial claim to fame was transforming Target and Apple retail. What did he do that brought him this fame?
Johnson's whole career was retailing. After he got an MBA from Harvard, like me, he went to work at Mervyn's. And then he went to Target, where he became vice president of merchandising. And he scored his first big success. Johnson was the guy who turned Target into Target. And he did this by redesigning the stores and product line to appeal to a younger and trendier audience. So it's certainly a success. But it was at Apple where he had his biggest hit. Under Johnson, Apple's retail stores achieved a record level of growth, exceeding $1 billion in annual sales within 2 years of their debut. And that surpassed the previous record set by Gap. Also, the stores were wildly profitable and blew past competitors on every possible metric. In 2011, sales per square foot per year were more than $3,000. To put that in perspective, that's almost twice that of Tiffany, which is ranked number 2.
The jewelry retailer, right?
Exactly. So it's pretty amazing.
Wow.
So anyway, Johnson was a star at what was then the hottest company on the planet. So he had some major cachet going here.
I understand he got frustrated when Tim Cook was chosen as Steve Jobs' successor at Apple. Why was he frustrated? And what happened then?
Well, Johnson wanted to be a CEO. He wanted to put his mark on a company. And this sort of leads us into the JCPenney chapter of his career. In 2010, JCPenney was in trouble. Unlike most of its competitors, it wasn't recovering from the Great Recession. And this is primarily because its customers, who tended to be middle-class moms, had really suffered heavily during the recession, and they just still hadn't returned. They just weren't buying. So something had to give. In October, Mike Ullman, Penny's CEO, got a call from a guy named Stephen Roth. Roth and another investor named Bill Ackman announced they were purchasing 26% of Penny's stock in the belief that the company's value could be dramatically increased, provided some changes were made. Rather than resist Roth and Ackman, Ullman invited him to join the Penny board. Now, the board was already concerned about Ullman's leadership and health, and this really came to a head when he was injured in an auto accident in February 2011 and then spent 12 weeks in recovery.
Wow. Well,
yeah, really. So Ullman's ability to continue as CEO was really uncertain, and there were no apparent successors at Penny. So what to do? Ullman and the board reached out to Ron Johnson at this point. It turned out Ullman had actually reached out to Johnson before to see if he would be interested in joining the board. Johnson at the time said no, but it turns out he was interested in the CEO position. So he joined the company as CEO in November of 2011.
That's kind of weird though, right? If you were a retailer, someone wanted your help, you could get an introduction to the business by being on their board, and that still would provide a channel for you to become the CEO, but he rejected it initially.
I really don't know what the reason was behind that, whether he was just so completely enmeshed in Apple, he didn't want to divide his bandwidth.
Oh, true.
The other thing, too, is that at the time, I think he may have still been a contender for the Apple CEO.
Right.
It was prior to the Cook announcement.
Right.
We're just speculating here. There are a couple of possible reasons, though. Less than 3 months after joining the company, Johnson unveiled his new vision for JCPenney. It included an entirely new boutique layout for the stores, a slew of new upscale brands, and a simplified pricing strategy that abandoned Penny's traditional promotional pricing in favor of simplified value pricing. And this was a risk. Moving away from a promotional pricing model the customers were used to was taking a big chance, even if the consumer would actually be getting a better deal. I've spent some time in retail, and it's a hard thing to do, but Ron Johnson was going to go for it.
So who else tried this?
I was a consultant for A&P for a while. They tried it. The standard is EDLP, everyday low pricing.
Walmart is known for that, right?
Yeah, but Walmart is sort of a special case, but think about retail and pricing. The real promotional pricing was pioneered by Kmart and their blue light special, where people would actually run through the stores with these flashing blue lights and, oh, this is the promotion, this is the hot deal. In the traditional model of pricing up a standard retail, the pricing down a promotion is just sort of ingrained in a lot of consumers. So even if the premise is that by giving everyday low pricing, the consumer is actually getting a better deal, the consumer may not feel that way.
Plus, there's a feeling of entertainment when you're in the store,
yep.
Right? Like, who knows what could happen? So it's not necessarily that they're being motivated by the price itself, but by the spectacle of getting a great deal.
The perception of a promotion.
This
is classic. So he was going to go forward with that, and it was a three-tiered system. And it actually, you know, it made sense.
Was it the same as Target, though? Because he had already done Target.
It was somewhat different. There were three pricing tiers. There was a standard price, a discount price, and then a clearance price. But again, if you put that in the context of where Penny was, the consumers were used to promotions. Oh my God, this is on promotion. This is on sale. I'm going to buy it now. It was just a different habit from the standpoint of the consumer. Not only did he have this grand vision and this restructuring of the pricing, he was going to do it fast because the whole vision was accompanied by an aggressive rollout plan that called for revamping hundreds of stores by the fall of that year. He was not being timid here. He was not doing any limited roll-up thing. He was going to go for it. And that's what happened. The board, they were somewhat stunned by the ambitions of this plan, but they didn't resist and they didn't push for testing or a slower launch. And actually, Fortune magazine may have put it best, as if Johnson, he had a new team, he had an adoring board of directors and a mission to reinvent his company. And off he went. But it didn't quite go according to plan. Costs started mounting, revenues fell. Penny was alienating and losing its existing customers and not getting new ones. That's critical. Some of the directors started expressing concerns, and in early 2013, when they finalized 2012 results, it was a catastrophe. Revenues were down by $4.3 billion. Same-store sales had declined by 25%, and the company reported a $1 billion loss for that year. That's pretty serious. Johnson offered to resign. And the board initially asked him to stay, stuck with them initially, but eventually accepted his resignation. In April 2013, Less than a year and a half after the introduction of his grand vision for JCPenney, the company announced that Ron Johnson was stepping down as CEO.
So the total amount lost here was $1 billion.
Well, yeah, they lost $1 billion in 2012. But you got to remember, there's some other things. To do a financial analysis, you'd have to put some kind of a baseline together. And I'm not sure that's really doable, because you'd have to say, well, if the company didn't do anything, what would have happened? You got to think about some of the losses that aren't necessarily financial. Penny lost faith with its customer base. It lost its key customers. It lost its employees. There were massive layoffs. It lost all their wisdom. It lost credibility with the suppliers, and the board lost credibility as well, and both Roth and Ackman resigned. So it's a lesson to learn, and retail's a lot harder than it may seem. Ullman's initial comments were, to quote, "These are two of the smartest people in their industries in America. Why wouldn't we want them in the boardroom?" Well, there's no doubt that Roth and Ackman were smart, but they certainly missed something at JCPenney, and they missed it big time.
And having sharks like that in the boardroom could be dangerous. And apparently, it really was. So Johnson was fired from JCPenney. He was licking his wounds, wondering what to do next. He had a 25,000-square-foot house in Atherton, California, with plenty of cash remaining from his time at Target and Apple. We don't have to feel sorry for the guy.
He's still shooting chip shots in his backyard, I believe, too.
Yeah. I saw his house plans.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's a big palatial place.
And well-deserved. I mean, he earned it.
Yeah, of course. So his motivation for leaving Apple was to lead a company, which he did. He left because Tim Cook was the designated successor for Steve Jobs. So Johnson had something to prove, and the JCPenney failure meant he still had something to prove. So Johnson constructed a vision for a startup company, and in 2014, he announced that his company, Enjoy.com, had raised $30 million from some well-known venture capitalists. In later rounds, they raised another $370 million in venture capital. So there's Ron Johnson and Enjoy.com with a big pile of investment capital. He takes the company public in 2019 with a SPAC to raise an additional $115 million after redemptions. And in 2022, Enjoy.com, just a couple of weeks ago, declared bankruptcy. So bankruptcy is not the end of Enjoy.com, because it has customers and assets, but all those Enjoy.com investors have lost $515 million. And a lot of employees are now wondering about their future. So $1 billion of lost profits at JCPenney, $515 million of lost investment capital at Enjoy.com. That money could have been used for more productive things. We can call those two events failures, and then analyze why those failures occurred. In this episode, we're going to focus on the JCPenney specifics, what specifically went wrong and why. This is classic failure analysis. Looking closely and objectively at failures is fundamental to mindfulness. We'll wrap up the episode with an 80-year history of agile management philosophies and how failures drove large-scale changes in manufacturing and software management. So let's dive deeper into JCPenney and why did it fail. One of the things that I first noticed about this story is that at Target, Ron Johnson was there for 14 years or something?
Yeah, something like that.
Or 16 years?
Yeah, so somewhere around there.
Yeah, so he was vice president of merchandising. Mm-hmm. He was surrounded by guardrails, effectively, right? So he was operating with the help of others to succeed.
Yeah, there was a key designer that he really collaborated with in terms of the redesign of Target.
Michael Graves or something like that?
Yeah, that's who I was thinking. It was Michael Graves. So it was more of a collaboration.
I see. Interesting. And he was operating from limits, right? Like, so it was Target and they had constraints on the capital that they could use to execute on the strategy. When he was at Apple, he had fewer constraints, but In both cases, he was surrounded by management, and so he was collaborating with them. He had limits on what he could do, right?
Yeah, you think about Apple, he had Steve Jobs on top of him. There's an ongoing discussion, really, in terms of how much of the Apple Store credit goes to Johnson and how much goes to Jobs. I don't want to get into that because I just don't know. And I'm still willing to give Johnson the credit for all of that. I mean, he certainly was the leader of the team. He certainly invented the Genius Bar. To your point, yeah, it was a collaboration. He was a member of a team. He may have been the leader of a team, but it was a team.
He did have to appease different areas of the business.
Yeah.
Whereas as a CEO, he wouldn't have quite so many constraints. When you've been a CEO, you think you have all this power as CEO, but actually you have to get the collaboration and assent of other people if you want to succeed.
Well, it depends how you operate. It's the CEO who is responsible to the board. In the case of Penny, the board had Roth and Ackman. The board just basically gave Johnson a blank check. In my experience, my boards have been a lot, shall we say, stricter than that in terms of the amount of flexibility you had. Certainly, they gave you a running room, but by the same token, you just couldn't say, okay, go do what you're going to do. We trust you. We're going to leave you alone. That was a rather unique situation. Johnson came in with an incredible resume. I mean, let's face it, what he did is at the Apple stores is still amazing in terms of all of their metrics and things like that. You got to give him credit.
Yeah. I've been to many Apple stores and I have appreciated being in those Apple stores as well. So the board was passive.
Mm-hmm.
Ackman was kind of a bull in a china shop, I think, sort of forcing his way in. It reminds me of corporate raiders that go in and want to buy out a company and then fire a bunch of people and completely transform them. This has that feeling, despite the fact that it was voluntary, right?
Well, there was a quote, actually, and it was one of the articles that we went through in researching this podcast. And the quote was, if you wake up one morning and somebody's bought 26% of your company, you know something's happening. I mean, it was certainly that, but in between both Roth and Ackman, I've got a caveat that I don't know either of these gentlemen, but I'm sure that they've had their own successes. And so there was a fair amount of self-confidence or maybe even arrogance going on.
Right. Also, the board was full of fear too, right? They felt that JCPenney was losing market share. It had this stable management under Mike Ullman for a long time, but Mike's health was declining and they might not survive.
Yeah, and think about the impact of the recession. It really just absolutely bullseyed their key customer base.
Yeah, exactly. All right, so one problem is no guardrails on the CEO.
Mm-hmm.
So then another problem occurred that expenses around restructuring were uncontrolled, right? I read about Ron Johnson not actually living in Plano, Texas, or not having an apartment there. So he was flying in and out of Plano from the San Francisco Bay Area in his private jet. If he did that every week, the rough cost is $1.2 million per year. And I assumed those charges went to JCPenney. So that is in general administrative expenses, right?
Yeah, well, it wasn't just Johnson. It was, I think, with one exception, the entire senior management team commuted in.
Oh, they all piled into his private jet?
I don't know whose private jet they used or what, but there was some talk about an off-campus headquarters at the Ritz-Carlton.
Oh, wow.
Where everybody stayed when they were in Plano. So,
right.
Yeah, there's a lot of that happening, and that has to do with the integration of the management team with the company.
Right. They weren't rubbing elbows with the existing folks. They were all separate in this kind of isolated echo chamber.
When I was at GE Consumer Electronics, a new general manager came in, and one of the questions was, well, are you renting or buying? He said, I just bought a house.
Oh, bought a house at the location of his job.
Yeah, exactly. And the location is that, okay, I'm committed. You may say that's symbolic and who cares, but things like that matter.
Yeah. So that was one set of expenses, the general administrative expenses. They were making tons of brand changes too. So they went around and solicited boutique retailers to put their little sub stores in JCPenney's, right?
Yeah.
Was there a cost around that?
In some cases, yes. I think it was Levi's, where they restructured the boutique approach, the store within the store, and Penny picked up a lot of those costs. I can't say it's the case of every one of them, but certainly Penny did bear some of those costs. But I think the bigger cost issue was the one associated with the speed of the rollout. You didn't do any experimentation. You didn't do any incremental change here. You basically just lit the fuse and off it went. If you could measure the profit impact on a limited basis and you could sit there and say, well, this isn't going to work. Okay, fine. It's not going to kill the company. But if you do it over the entire store base, I mean, you're either going to have a massive success or you're going to have a massive failure. Let's face it.
Yeah. And there were also management changes. They fired a bunch of existing executives and replaced them with folks from Apple.
Yep.
Is that right?
Yeah. They started out with a special group. I think it was called the I-Team. There were existing employees that were supposed to be part of the change dynamic. But they ended up letting most of those people go. So I mean, if you look at the management that was in place when Johnson first joined the company, it was effectively hollowed out.
I see. And I think they paid these new Apple executives much more than what the previous JCPenney executives were paid.
Yeah, I believe that's the case. It was a high-priced management team, let's put it that way.
Right. We did talk previously about how there were no constraints on the CEO. In a sense, that allowed the CEO, Ron Johnson, to think big. And sometimes we've heard people around business saying, thinking big makes all the difference, you know. But on the other hand, many of those people who think big, they say, I'm going to think big, but I'm actually going to operate in the small for the time being. I'm going to use low-cost experiments to see whether my big thinking idea is likely to succeed. And if not, learn more about what could succeed.
Yeah.
But we didn't see that in the attitude of the CEO. Without guardrails, he was free to do anything. And this expenses situation is an example of taking those limits away. He just started spending gobs of money in a big bang. It wasn't even a test, really, right? It was I'm so smart that spending all this money is guaranteed to succeed.
He was on CBS Sunday Morning. I remember seeing the show, and one of his comments, failure is not an option. I hate this comment, not attributed to him firstly, but because a lot of people use it.
Failure is a possibility always, regardless of how we might wish it never were true. I suppose failure is not an option because you don't consider it as a possibility. But even then, it's like you're saying, I'm willfully naive.
But you got to put yourself in his shoes. If I had had the level of success he had had at both Target and Apple, I would have a great deal of self-confidence, to put it mildly. So
yeah.
You can sort of understand where he was coming from. I'm sure that he believed in his soul that this was going to succeed. The interesting thing, if you go back to Agile, is that if there had been some experimentation, there could have been elements of this that could have been wildly successful. We don't know. But as a combined effort, it took the company down.
Right. So in the expenses side, just to get clear, they basically were spending heavily on G&A. They were spending heavily on brand changes. They were spending heavily on transforming every single store in the fleet. They were firing managers and replacing them with people. And so they lost institutional knowledge. All of that stuff taken together was really a powerful negative thing for their potential future. And it took options away, right? By spending all that money, they lost capital that they could have used for new ideas that might have arisen as they were experimenting. And then we can start talking about customer base. Mm-hmm. So they lost their existing customers. What was happening there?
Look at Johnson's experience at Target. He was doing something analogous. He was bringing in more boutique-y, higher-end brands to replace the ho-hum JCPenney brands. But the problem was there was one example, a private label, I believe it was a woman's brand, that they eliminated, and that was responsible by itself for $1 billion in revenue. And so it was this wholesale change. You're losing what you've got and you're not replacing it with something new.
Right now, I'm in Alma, Michigan in the rural Midwest. There was a JCPenney here prior to this change. People don't want to stand out. They don't want to look flashy or anything like that. And so these brands are very popular. Ron Johnson took them away.
that's basically just conservative. I happen to like khaki colored slacks. Some people would call that unimaginative, but I like that.
I'm originally from here, so I just wear Levi's all day long.
Yeah,
right?
So it's not a value judgment on the part of the customer. It's just respecting who your customer is and understanding
right.
what they want. And if you are going
right.
to make the decision, a conscious decision to change your brand profile, you need to understand how your current customers are going to react.
Yeah, yeah. If you were going to make this change, you could have tried it in a cosmopolitan area that would be more amenable to these things and see that it worked, right? And then they could gradually expand it to the rural Midwest if it was going to work, but they didn't do that. They just made the assumption that the product mix was really going to make a difference in terms of JCPenney's positioning all throughout the country. And it did make a difference, but a big negative difference.
Yeah, and remember, on top of that, you had the pricing changes, too.
Oh, right, right. So they eliminated promotional pricing, and yet the customer was used to that.
Yeah.
So, and as you said, there's been a lot of companies that have tried to eliminate promotional pricing. He didn't listen to what other retailers had seen. I can imagine saying, oh, I've got a better idea, but he didn't even test whether that really was a better idea. There was an executive there from the original JCPenney's. I think his name was Steve Johnson. So Steve was advocating testing. Mm. And then when they ran into some budgeting issues, Steve Johnson conveniently was cut.
Remember, again, where Johnson was coming from, Apple. I mean, Steve Jobs completely rejected testing. He thought the whole thing was a waste of time.
Right.
Some of that had to sink in terms of Ron Johnson's experience.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So bye-bye, Steve Johnson, because mm-hmm. you're messing up my vibe.
Mm-hmm.
That is an interesting thing about Ron Johnson. When you read about him, he is sensitive to people messing up his vibe, right? Some listeners might assume leaders always fire people who disagree with them, but the best leaders often respect dissenting voices, as long as when a decision is made, employees support it in their actions. But Ron Johnson didn't seem to be that type of guy.
Again, having not worked for the guy or know the guy personally, I can't say that as a fact, but it certainly seems that way.
Yeah, yeah. He also did some promotional differences, too. He brought in Ellen DeGeneres to be a representative of JCPenney's. And that was okay. She was a popular star, but a whole bunch of things happened at once, right? Like Ellen DeGeneres, and then they put out ads showing two moms and two dads. And then there was the Million Mom March people who got angry about that. They actually started a boycott of JCPenney's.
To look back at their core customer, you had a very conservative bunch of people, and they just didn't react well to these new ads. The intention of the ads, I understand it. They're trying to be more inclusive.
Right.
And I applaud that, but they're being inclusive, and rightfully or wrongfully, the existing customer base is getting ticked off.
I have my own bias here because I'm gay, so I appreciate that Ellen DeGeneres, two moms and two dads, appeared in these advertisements. But I'm also practical. If you're trying to create more inclusiveness in your store, in society, it's counterproductive to generate antagonism that destroys the vehicle, namely JCPenney, that is advancing inclusiveness. It takes mindfulness to finesse this, and it seems like they weren't very mindful about it.
So you've got a confluence of things happening here. You've got product, you've got pricing, you've got promotions, you've got advertise, I mean, just a whole ton of stuff that sort of combined to effectively alienate their existing customers.
Right, right. We're going through these different aspects of the business, and in each case, we're seeing that there was a lot of arrogance, a lot of putting all of their eggs in one basket. So now we can talk about the staff that had been working with JCPenney's for years, understood the customer very well, thought they were doing the right thing, probably felt the same kinds of fears that the board felt, that they were worried about growing irrelevance of JCPenney's. But they were still wanting to succeed, right? And here comes the new guy. So the staff was demoralized.
Yeah, but understand, at first they weren't. When Johnson first showed up, this is the Messiah. This is the Savior. And so the initial reaction was excitement. But then once the reality set in, and it's actions speak louder than words type of a thing. We've already talked about the fact that the senior management team basically didn't move to Plano. And they sort of cloistered themselves in the Ritz-Carlton. So they really didn't associate with the existing employees. It even came down to the point where they were demeaned. There was this acronym DOPES, dumb old pennies employees. So there was a lack of respect. And the Apple stores, that is a rather unique retail experience and environment. Mm. And to take that and to apply it into a department store experience, like a Penny's or a Macy's, it just works differently.
You don't have the kind of high profit margins. You don't have the kind of controls and things like that.
I don't think these people coming in from Apple were stupid. I think it's just that the retail background was skewed because of this remarkable experience with the Apple stores.
Right, right. If you've been to an Apple store, it feels like a very high-end experience. And the customer base for Apple products is high-end as well. So you pay a higher price for an iPhone, for example, than an Android.
And from an operating standpoint, the margins in an Apple store are astronomical compared to standard retail. So you can get away with a lot of stuff there. Mm. You've got a lot more margin to play with. So you can provide all these services and these high-level staff and all of these other things.
Yeah.
Whereas in the traditional retail experience, it just doesn't work the same way.
The staff, obviously, with the kind of attitude that we're hearing about Ron Johnson and his new folks that had come in, they really didn't have input into the decision-making. So they did have institutional knowledge about the previous customer base, and it just wasn't taken into account.
Yeah, I understand. I mean, there's nothing wrong with culture change, and sometimes it needs to happen. God knows how many books and all of these tricks and things like that that people do. But the people that are on the ground when you get there, I don't want to say this is also always the case, but I got thrown into a lot of companies. You got to respect the wisdom that's inherent in the company. And it may not be all right, may not be all wrong, who knows, but you got to at least respect it. And this just didn't happen.
All right. So lastly, we can talk about the theory that this transition to this new JCPenney style would attract a new customer base that would more than make up for any losses to the old customer base, right? And that didn't happen.
No, it didn't, despite the marketing campaigns that were trying to be more inclusive and so forth. I got to give Johnson a little bit of a break here. At least one article, he's saying that Penny should have stuck with the strategy longer than they did. The store transitions were still underway when he left. So it's not like the whole redone thing was out there operating. Actually, it's some of the new pricing got pulled back midstream. In an agile environment, if you had taken a single market and really put the program in place all the way and gotten hard data about it, you would have been infinitely better than if you had blown the whole country wide open like they did.
Right. If they had taken a narrow market, like, let's say, a San Francisco or a New York.
Or a Chicago or a Peoria or whatever.
Or a Peoria, right. But if they had made this transformation, and then think about the amount of capital that they would have to try different things to serve that market. And it may be that even the original model could have been amazing. They could have tested it in Peoria and discovered that it took a while to transition the customer, to get them used to the new pricing model, to attract the new customer base that would enjoy this model more, and then discover the actual cost of rolling out this new strategy. Now you can budget that and you can go to investors or lenders and say, we're going to make this giant transition. It's going to cost a lot, probably more than $1 billion with this initial rollout, but it's going to cost a lot, but it's going to be worth it. And here we have proof, right? So now the investors will be on board with you. But because they didn't do any testing, they didn't have any data that they could confidently go to a lender or an investor and say, hey, you know what? Back this thing. We've got lots of signal showing that this is going to be a successful strategy. So it's sad, right? It could have been successful. We just don't know. And part of the reason we don't know is because we didn't use testing or experimentation.
JCPenney is a national brand, and I accept that. But I got to believe, and especially in the terms of the strategy that Johnson was espousing, where you had multiple individual boutiques inside the shell with a town square in the middle, that you could change your product mix for different parts of the country.
Right.
And so it may have been actually a situation where you could adapt. Talk about San Francisco. Certainly the market there is going to be different than a Peoria or whatever. And that's fine. This model could actually have an advantage in terms of being able to adapt to those individual markets. And they didn't have a chance because of the lack of an agile approach. They didn't have a chance to test that.
This was Ron Johnson's first CEO role, and it was a really big one with no guardrails. The corporate board of directors was fearful of doing nothing. It didn't have any ideas of its own. They hired Wunderkind Ron Johnson as a great savior. He spent money at an extravagant rate, first to support his executive staff, many of whom commuted from the San Francisco Bay Area, and it cost money to build new boutiques for stores within the store model, and it cost money to transform every single store in the fleet. The new staff created tribes by denigrating former JCPenney staff, and of course by not joining the Plano community. They lost a lot of institutional knowledge when they let a bunch of existing employees go. They dumped lucrative private labels that appealed to their existing customer base and lost $1 billion in revenue. They made big pricing changes, replacing promotional pricing with an everyday low price model few retailers had successfully executed. JCPenney wanted to appeal to a hipper crowd, so they brought in Ellen DeGeneres, a famous lesbian talk show host. Americans loved her. That makes sense. Then they blasted out ads showing two moms and two dads. The Million Mom March folks started a boycott of JCPenney's. So all of these costs and lost revenues might have been okay if the driving theory had been true, that providing trendy brands would attract a new customer base or convert the existing customer base. But it didn't. Why should we do failure analysis? Failure motivated at least two radical management frameworks that were adopted by almost all companies in a sector. Smart folks first analyzed failures, then constructed counterintuitive frameworks to prevent failure. The first framework is lean manufacturing, which is today used by virtually all automobile manufacturers and many other manufacturers. Toyota created this framework in the 1950s when faced with a national crisis in Japan. They were emerging from World War II after the industrial base had been bombed into oblivion. Toyota studied American manufacturers like Ford and decided if they wanted to compete, they had to do something radically better. Their model was just-in-time manufacturing. They didn't start building the car until the minute someone ordered it, and then they scrambled to assemble all the pieces. Initially, Japanese cars were crappy, but they supported a team-based experimental philosophy in the company, and they definitely had a philosophy. They called it Toyota Production System. It encouraged team collaboration on building cars, defined waste very broadly, and described how decisions converged from an ongoing dialogue between leaders and workers throughout the organization. When you get trained in Toyota Production System, or now lean manufacturing, you adopt a mindset, a philosophy, and it goes far beyond your work life because it helps you at home too. So did it work? We could do a whole episode on this with some great stories, but in short, yes. Toyota was the most profitable car manufacturer in the world in 2008, but it wasn't the most productive. It produced fewer cars with a higher profit margin. In contrast, General Motors produced a lot of cars, but went bankrupt in 2009, just a year later. General Motors got a lot of support from government to rebuild, but then in 2021, Toyota became the most productive car manufacturer. It produced more cars with a higher profit than any other in the world. It now makes twice as much as General Motors. Switching gears to the software industry, in the 1980s, a growing number of massive software project failures started to become obvious. About a third of software projects were failing. And by this term, I mean they were either abandoned completely or they were released to clients who refused to use them. The cost of some failed projects were in the millions, and a few reached $1 billion. Stressed out managers would often assume that software project failures were due to insufficient planning. So engineers planned more, and failures got worse. But some wise folks started to realize that because software development was a fundamentally creative process, it couldn't be predicted long term. This is when iterations, low-cost team-based experimentation, and other approaches became the norm. Many frameworks were developed during this time, and this framework category is generally termed agile. You'll sometimes hear developers bellyache about agile techniques because they're now used everywhere and they require discipline. But they saved many software projects. About 10% of agile software projects fail versus a third of traditionally managed software projects. The most popular agile framework is Scrum. Scrum is more general than most such frameworks. It has been applied to a wide variety of project fields, including education, marketing, finance, and corporate organization. Agile practitioners in the software world borrow freely from other fields. All these frameworks play well together. So some colleagues and I have started to refer to any collaborative, experimental, waste-reducing framework as agile. To summarize, failure analysis led to new outcomes in manufacturing and software. Agile practices are now spreading to other areas, including overall business management. I don't know whether I said all this to convince you it's worth your time to do failure analysis because of the opportunity to develop new ways to succeed, or to give you a little backgrounder on agile history. But maybe I've done both. This is the first of what we think will be three episodes on Ron Johnson. The next episode will lay out characteristics of agile and mindful organizations and discuss specific examples of the JCPenney transformation that would have been done differently with that philosophy. If you liked this episode, be sure to join us for the next two. To get a reminder when the next episode drops, be sure to follow the podcast in your favorite podcast app, or get on our mailing list at mindfulagility.com. Marilla Patali normally guides a meditation related to the episode following our close. We don't have a guided meditation for this episode, but we will likely have one for the next one. Many thanks to Dan Dixon for the idea of analyzing Ron Johnson and for joining me in this episode. We got great feedback on beta versions of this episode from reviewers. They were Amelia Hambrecht, Jeff Stewart, Laurit Loy, Dan D'Agostino, Tanya Constares, Janet O'Brien, Matt Zimmerman, Mona Wassenaar-Herson, and Divya Mays. Thank you so much, everybody. The Mindful Agility Community, a Facebook group, helps direct our efforts. Sometimes excerpts from those meetings end up in our podcast. We'd love to have you join. I'm Dan Greening. See you next time. Thank you.